Welcome to the High Tech Forum Podcast. I'm Richard Bennett, and I'm joined today by Shane Tews, my colleague at American Enterprise, for a lively discussion about wireless technology. Hi, Shane.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
Pretty good, and Happy New Year.
To you, too.
So you took a pass on CES this year, huh?
I did. The first time I've missed it in about 10 years, and I followed it through the news reports, but it wasn't as much fun as walking the thousands of feet of floor that they have there and seeing all the gizmos and gadgets up front.
Yeah, it seems like the main theme might have been virtual reality, certainly according to the press coverage, both before and after the show. Writers are really touting virtual reality, which is sort of one of these deja vu all over again things, because that was a big theme. And in the late 80s and late 90s, it just seems to come around every 10 years. And I guess eventually it'll be here to stay.
Well, that and IoT, I keep hearing that my refrigerator is going to get smarter. And at least the demo models have more to show this year. But my refrigerator is still pretty much just a refrigerator.
Yeah, it's quite amazing the advances that are taking place in that field. I was just sort of thinking about what happens when I get up in the morning. My Apple Watch wakes me up. I go into the bathroom, the presence sensing, the light switch turns the light on. I take a shower. My humidity sensing fan switch turns the fan on when it needs to, and then leaves it on. I brush my teeth with a Bluetooth toothbrush. Cook my breakfast in a Bluetooth-enabled smart pressure cooker, and, you know, that's just the beginning.
Or you could be like me. My Nest isn't working still.
Yeah, well, I think that's a nationwide problem, didn't they? They pushed out a bad update, and all the Nest thermostats crashed.
I can't convince it that my Wi-Fi router is working. I have disconnected and reconnected my Wi-Fi router several times to make sure that I'm not the crazy one. Which that isn't actually a proof point, I realize. But yeah, my Nest, I have to go manually override it, and it's been going on for several days. So that's yet to be fixed, which gives you a little bit of pause before you let it start controlling your entire life.
Yeah, I've got a Nest, but it's sitting on a table because the thing that I have, I can actually control through Siri.
Oh.
And I'm just kind of getting everything I do is pretty much Siri mediated, you know, when for the most part, she can pretty much handle just about everything if you catch her in the right mood.
I've made my Siri an Australian male, but he's still named Siri.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, the lady who's the voice for Siri is named Susan Bennett. She follows me on Twitter.
Oh, really? Is she any relation?
No, I don't think so. I think she's British, actually.
Yeah, well, I didn't think that you could almost be related to Siri.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, one of the things that I noticed reading the reports was that there was a little bit of dialogue going on about whether or not people were using Wi-Fi versus Bluetooth on their devices for connectivity. And I understand a little bit about that, but I'm not completely clear on I didn't realize you would pick one over the other. So why would you pick Bluetooth over Wi-Fi, and why would they even be compatible?
Well, in the IoT space, there actually are three major options for connectivity. So there's Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, and then there's also some stuff that uses the 900 megahertz band, such as Zigbee.
Okay.
And then
Zigbee at all, so you're going to have to explain that.
So Zigbee is just it's another short-range communication standard, sort of like Bluetooth. Zigbee actually is more closely aligned with IEEE 802 standards than Bluetooth is, because Bluetooth was actually produced by a consortium of manufacturers who just came up with a standard on their own, and they did run it through 802 at one point, but, you know, not all the updates have gone through there. So it's Zigbee it's a different approach, because Bluetooth is very simple. It's essentially a point-to-point system, which means that if you have a headset and a phone, you can use Bluetooth to wed your headset to your phone, and that's all it'll do. And, you know, in many instances, that's really all you want it to do. But with Zigbee, you could actually create a mesh network of, you know, multiple headsets and multiple phones, hook them all together, and, you know, they could pass packets around the house. So these are very limited distance, you know, communication mechanisms. Like, typically Bluetooth will only work reliably at about 20 to 30 feet. So if you wanted to have connectivity throughout an office or throughout a home with a 30-foot communication system, you just have to make every device a relay. So if, as long as you have some sort of a Zigbee-compatible device every 30 feet, then the devices can form a network among themselves and, you know, get the data around the house, which is where the way a lot of consumer, the lighting control systems work in both offices and homes. The light switch itself has some sort of really, has a 900 megahertz radio in it that it uses to communicate with a little base station, and then the base station either uses Wi-Fi or Ethernet to connect to the cloud.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so the some of the gear that I've got uses that. I've got some 900 megahertz dimmable light switches, and so there are got that stuff and the Wi-Fi, the Bluetooth and the Ethernet and DOCSIS all sort of happily working together through the miracle of Internet protocol. Doesn't really matter that much, you know, what the physical layer system is. They all have, you know, some benefits. The nice thing about the 900 megahertz stuff is that it's very power efficient. And Bluetooth has not, up until Bluetooth 4, which is also called Bluetooth Smart or Bluetooth Low Energy, Bluetooth was not at all power efficient. So, you know, you had Bluetooth devices that were powered by little coin-type batteries, and those things would go flat in a week or so. But with Bluetooth 4, the low energy stuff, the batteries will last a year, maybe even 2 years. And it's an example of the Bluetooth standard actually learning something from the proprietary networking stuff that the fitness industry was doing. Garmin, in particular, invented a very energy efficient use of the 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, the same unlicensed spectrum that's used by Bluetooth and by Wi-Fi. So they invented a very power-efficient way to use that, and then the Bluetooth people more or less cribbed that general notion and made it part of the Bluetooth standard, which is kind of fine with Garmin because they didn't want to keep on being the, you know, the maintainer of you know, networking protocols. It's kind of not their thing. They want to be focused on GPSs and fitness gear.
Now, one of the things I saw mentioned was something called Wi-Fi Direct. So how is that different than regular Wi-Fi? Is that a different protocol or just one off of the Wi-Fi?
It's an optional form. They're actually, people don't generally realize this, but Wi-Fi is not just a single, it's not just a single protocol or a single standard. It's a family of protocols. So Wi-Fi historically has had a mode, a polled access mode that works an awful lot like a cellular, like the cellular network does. With it has something called a scheduler that determines when the different devices have permission to transmit. That's not widely used because the use case for that is pretty much phone calls and video, but we're able to meet those needs with Wi-Fi without the complexity that system entails. But then there's the more commonly used thing, which is called enhanced distributed communications access, and it's standard Wi-Fi, and it's the kind of thing where your device talks to the access point, and then the access point relays the communication to its destination, which is typically the internet. But if the destination is actually within the same network as the source, bouncing it, making two hops to go from the device, from the originating device to the access point, and then from the access point to the destination device is a bit inefficient. So Wi-Fi Direct enables the access point to set up a direct connection. So if you had you have a TiVo with Wi-Fi and it wants to stream video to your smart TV set, the best path for that is just to go direct from the TiVo to the TV set, and they're typically located adjacent to each other, and the access point may be in a completely different part of the house anyway. So Wi-Fi Direct is just a way that Wi-Fi effectively mimics Bluetooth, but just at a higher power level, so it can go 300 feet instead of 30 feet.
And then I saw today that Apple made an announcement. They've created something they're going to start introducing called Li-Fi.
Yeah, I think they were saying that somebody had found some code in the phone that would support Li-Fi. I'm not sure. I mean, Apple, I don't think, has announced that they're ready to use it yet.
Okay. But what is it?
This is another deja vu thing. Because back in the early 90s, when I started working on Wi-Fi, I was a consultant with a company called Photonics that was a spinoff from Apple, founded by a guy named Dick Allen, who had been Apple's local networking guy. And for people who aren't a million years old, maybe it's worthwhile to remember that Apple was actually the first really big supplier of equipment that had local area network technology built into it. The original Mac was a device that could share laser printers, very expensive laser printers, and the way it did that was it had a local area network, very primitive local area network called AppleTalk, that was built into the Apple devices. And so the trouble with AppleTalk, like, you know, all local area networks that depend on wires, is that wiring offices and homes can be a real chore. So what Photonics did was they made a wireless version of AppleTalk that they called a PhotoLink, and it used infrared to connect, you know, your Macs to your printer. And the folks at Photonics realized that was a whole lot bigger opportunity than just, you know, extending AppleTalk. So they took part in the consortium of companies that developed the original Wi-Fi standard. And the original Wi-Fi standard actually had two physical network options. One was the radio stuff, radio frequency stuff that we use most commonly today. But the other was an infrared option that built on the Photonics system. And they had a common protocol above the physical layer, what's called in standards terminology, the media access control protocol, kind of does for local area networks what IP does for wide area networks. So we can have all these different technologies that all communicate with each other because they share a common internet protocol element. And the MAC protocol and Wi-Fi enabled both the infrared and the radio frequency stuff to work together. So using light as a way to transport bits through the air is actually it's a pretty good thing. One of the benefits back in the early 90s was there were health concerns about the effect of radio waves on the developing brains of children, and we wanted to sell our product to schools. And so without commenting on the validity of of those claims from a medical perspective, we figured it was a little bit less scary for people to have infrareds, because we're pretty familiar with those from TV remote controls and what have you. It's just light, right? Can't hurt you.
Right. Hopefully not.
And so now we've kind of gone full circle. And in the development of technology for radio, for wireless communication, let's say, there's sort of two major schools of thought. One of them is trying to use things like opportunistic spectrum access and unlicensed spectrum, cognitive radios and that sort of thing, to make somehow more efficient use or more ease of use and access to a radio frequency spectrum. And the other point of view is, look, guys, you know, radio frequency spectrum, no matter how well we engineer it, is going to be crowded because we're talking about a very limited part of the overall spectrum of electromagnetic frequencies and that we can use for communication. So why don't we go up to higher frequencies that no devices are using today? Because we haven't had technology in the past that would really enable them to be used for data transport. We have faster chips, higher frequency chips. We have the ability to do signal processing. We go up into the higher frequencies. There's no incumbent application there, and there's no rights to worry about. So we can just exploit, you know, high frequencies, and they're extremely high bandwidth. So the potential for doing building, you know, really fat data pipes, well, that's where it lies, is primarily in the higher frequencies. So that's what's happening in 5G. So the next evolution of the cellular phone network is going to incorporate access to millimeter wave frequencies. It's going to go from, say, 30 gigahertz up to 60 gigahertz. And there's no incumbents to worry about, so you can just have a ball. And the only problem is you got to get it to work. Well, and then the next frontier after that is what's called free space optics, which is basically visible light. So when we're in the realm of visible light, this is another example of, it's an unlicensed frequency, and you know there are some incumbent applications in visible light, like the sun and light bulbs. But you know, it turns out there are tricks you can play with as light bulb technology is moving to LED, away from incandescent and fluorescent. LEDs are, you know, this is a solid state electronics technology that progresses according to Moore's law. And when we use fiber optic communications, the gigabit fiber networks and multi-gigabit fiber networks that are used for the internet backhaul and consumer grade, broadband connections from companies like Verizon and that little startup in Mountain View, what's their name, Google.
I think they're called Alphabet.
Oh, right. Yeah, they change their name. It's kind of like, I guess it's like changing your password every 10 years or so. You have to change your company name. Those are LEDs, or the transmitters that pulse the light waves that make fiber optic communications necessary. So it turns out that if you can do signal processing well enough, and you can focus your beams well enough, the cable part of a fiber optic cable network isn't really important. The thing that counts is the optical part. So there's a researcher who's developed a system where he actually just pulses LED light bulbs in a way that they can carry data, but they're pulsing at frequencies that are so fast they're not even perceptible to the human eye. So it's kind of like when people use steganography to embed information in the digital, into a JPEG image.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that. So you can piggyback a bit stream on the stream of photons that comes out of an LED light bulb, and that can carry data. So you just need to have a receiver that can pick it up, and it can distinguish the photons that are meant to just simply illuminate the area, which are pretty random, right, from the organized photons that are conveying information. So you separate the signal from the noise, which, you can do if given enough signal processing power, and you have an extremely high bandwidth data pipe. So the guy did a demo. There's a YouTube I can put up on the blog that shows the guy giving a live demonstration of this technology in front of an audience, and you can actually see him transmitting some video imagery through this visible light system that is just pulsing commercially available LED bulbs.
So will I be able to replace my current light bulbs with these faster, smarter light bulbs? Will they just be an exchange, a one-on-one exchange, so the second one's a lot smarter?
Well, the light bulb itself, I think, is pretty similar to the ones you have now, but I would think that the engineering problem with that is the backhaul. So I put a light bulb into a socket that's just on a power line. The power line is not really a very good medium for communication, so you still kind of have to have some way to get in and out of the visible light network. And I guess what people will probably do is make customized light bulbs, kind of like these. Philips has a color-changing LED that has a built-in wireless network that it uses, that connects to Siri and does all that kind of cool stuff.
And is the base of the light bulb part of the connectivity to make it smarter? Is that where they put the – so? I'm looking to see how they make the light bulb itself just so.
Well, there are probably going to be two or three different approaches to actually making the light bulb. I think there's one system in which you could just use a standard light bulb,
mm-hmm.
and you'd replace the socket with the socket becomes a little base station that has the signal processing apparatus in it.
Okay.
There could be another system where, you know, your light bulb socket has, you know, say a parallel data cable. There could be another one where the light bulb has maybe some Wi-Fi built into it. It depends, you know, the more extensive the transmitters and receivers are for this light wave system, which he calls Li-Fi, the less the need is for the backhaul to some sort of foreign system. So
they start to support themselves the more you have in a room, or?
Well, I mean, you need to have some electronics somewhere to do the pulsing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of different ways that you can connect the light bulb to a device that pulses it, that turns it on and off. I mean, that's really all it is just something to turn the bulb on and off at an extreme, you know, in millionths or billionths of a second. And there are lots of ways to do that.
Wow. So I guess the big question is cost. I don't know what that's going to cost yet for the upgrade, but it certainly does a lot.
Well, and electronics cost is always a function of volume.
That's true.
So in the initial stage, it might cost you something. I mean, these LED dimmable light switches are not cheap. The kind that, you know, that talk to IoT networks and, you know, home networks, those things can cost anywhere from $30 to $60.
And that's with the Zigbee technology in it?
Yeah, or something similar to that. It could, you know, the lots of different companies, GE makes them, and Lutron, and the big light switch manufacturers that have been making light switches for like 100 years. They're pretty much all in that space. But yeah, they generally range from $30 to $60. They have some sort of wireless protocol.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah, and they will get cheaper. They have actually, some of them have gotten cheaper. There's not like a tremendous upsurge of interest in that. I think, you know, a year ago, the message coming out of CES was it was going to be the year of IoT and everybody was going to have smart light switches in their homes. And it turns out a smart light switch doesn't really do that much for you. Because at the end of the day, you know, flipping the light switch on or off is not like a really burdensome activity that we really need to have automation do for us. And when we ask automation to do that for us, except in very special instances, it becomes sort of a stupid activity. I mean, I can set up a schedule for when my lights come on and go off, but that schedule doesn't really take account of where I am and if I want it to do that. So that's okay as a starting point, but in order to make it, you know, fully seamless, where say you walk around your office and the lights come on just where you need them to come on and they turn off where you don't need them, costs a lot of money. And because LED light bulbs are so energy efficient, it probably takes you 100 years to pay back in terms of energy saving, you know, the cost of the electronics to really finally control the schedule. So I think people with LED lights just sort of turn them on and leave them on because it doesn't really make that much difference on your energy bill. They're so efficient.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I think the other thing that kind of came out of CES that was a kind of an undercurrent was the fact that we're expecting the networks to be up and very efficient, and spectrum. I mean, obviously, spectrum is going to be big on a lot of the way these things get used. And there was an announcement this past week about FirstNet coming out. FirstNet's one of those things that was born really out of September 11th, and it's just taken them a long time to actually get to the process of setting it up. You can probably explain it a little bit better to me. I understand it's sort of a dual-use capability for a commercial carrier to utilize the spectrum when it's not being used by first responders. What are the first responders using right now?
Well, what they've always used is proprietary systems.
Okay.
So the need for FirstNet was really quite acutely demonstrated on September 11th because the Fire Department of New York and the Police Department of New York both had really rich, highly capable wireless communication systems that they bought from different vendors and who couldn't communicate with each other. So when the first responders needed to coordinate their activities on that unfortunate day, you know, their networking systems wouldn't allow them to do that. And so this is that's just that's really unacceptable. So one of the things that
the cops couldn't talk to the firemen, they could have been in immediate proximity with each other, they just couldn't connect to each other via their own equipment.
Yeah, the cops were talking to the firemen through their cell phones.
Oh.
Because their police dispatch systems and fire department dispatch systems couldn't interoperate.
I see. Okay. So they're trying to get them all in the same system.
The 9/11 commission identified a need for a nationwide first responder network that was uniform. And also address the fact that this is something, a statement from the White House that came up at an event that they held to get some input into what to do about FirstNet from a technology standpoint. And one of the famous lines was that the average American teenager has better communication capability today than first responders do.
Wow. Yeah, that's probably true.
And so, you know, the answer to that is, well, why don't we use the same technology that teenagers use?
Yeah, which is the cell phone. But then I guess that's texting.
Yeah, I mean, so you've got texting, you've got WhatsApp, you've got video chat, you've got, you know, video Skype, you've got standard voice communication. You've got all these different modes of communication that are possible through standard issue smartphones on LTE networks. And so it's a question of, you know, when those first responder systems were initially put in place, you know, it was like back in the 50s and 60s, and there really wasn't a standards-based alternative. The FCC, you know, throughout the 50s quite notoriously refused to license any spectrum for mobile phones because they regarded mobile phones as a toy that wasn't going to go anywhere.
Another brilliant move, right?
Forward-looking FCC that, well, I mean, some things haven't changed. The time has come, actually, when those specialized systems that are used by the cops and the fire departments can be discarded and replaced with standards-based systems. So all the capabilities that the cops say they need to have, like, walkie-talkie mode and something they call talk around, which is sort of a direct connection between two phones where the cell tower might have gone down. You can do all that stuff with apps. You know, pretty much every special requirement that the first responders have come up with, you can say there's an app for that. And if there's not, we can write one.
So what the U.S. government's doing is basically saying, rather than them building it, they're going to contract this out to a commercial carrier. And part of the carrot for the carrier is to be able to use the spectrum when the first responders aren't using it. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's one of the most peculiar contracts you've ever seen. It's kind of interesting to note how when this thing first started, it was going to be a system that was government owned and operated.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea didn't last very long. That status quo in first responder networks, I mean, it's not going to work. and it would be, you know, enormously expensive. So they're going to subcontract with wireless carriers, both large and small, to extend the coverage of the cellular network around the country. So they're going to build some additional brand new towers in areas that don't have any kind of 4G LTE wireless service today. The commercial operators are going to run this network for the government. They're going to give first responders priority over ordinary consumers, but the catch is, in a lot of instances, instead of the government paying the carriers to operate the network, the carriers are going to pay the government for the use of the first responder spectrum when the first responders don't need it.
Oh, kind of okay, so it's kind of a reverse thought process. So they get to use it with the idea that there's a first, you know, the first use is always for the responders.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able, because the systems are so much smarter now, to be able to toggle between commercial use and – so what happens if the commercial use needs to be abandoned for minutes when they go to the first responder for several hours?
Well, I mean, it's a spectrum allocation issue. It's the same problem that the cellular network has to operate when more than one people are more than one user is connected to a tower. They have to apportion the bandwidth between the users, and they can do that by taking into account the priority. So when the first responders want it, they get first access to that 20 megahertz of spectrum that's assigned to first responder networks. And the nice thing about their FirstNet being part of the commercial cellular network is that, you know, there are going to be times when the first responders need more than their 20 megahertz. And if that spectrum is available, then, you know, they can just sort of spill over into the commercial frequencies and use those as long as, you know, they're not, you know, previously assigned to one of the commercial users. So it's a dynamic sharing system between first responders and civilian users. That can be driven by whatever policy algorithms the carriers want to employ.
That seems like a much more efficient use. I know that spectrum is obviously a scarce resource that we keep trying to get the government to give up portions of it we don't think they're using. Is that where this is coming from? Is this coming from government allocation?
Yeah, there was and through the course of the digital television transition, the amount of total spectrum allocated to over-the-air television was essentially cut in half. And the so half of that original allocation was I forget how many, several hundred, 600 or 700 megahertz. Digital TV is somewhat, it's at least four times as efficient. So we were able to allow the broadcasters to triple the number of program streams that they can send out in a particular channel. And also take some of that spectrum and auction it off. So the 600 and 700 megahertz spectrum that's in use by cellular networks is spectrum that used to be analog TV. And then there was an allocation of 20 megahertz that came out of the auction process for first responders.
Okay, so that's fascinating. So they just announced this week. I guess we'll have to watch it and see who bids on it and what they decide to do with it. So it sounds like they get some flexibility as well. So this isn't completely dyed-in-the-wool contracting. They get to be a little innovative.
Yeah, I think what's happened over the 10-year period that they've been trying to figure out how to build FirstNet is that most of the discussions have really been about policy. The technology is pretty straightforward. I mean, you just use what the cellular operators are using. Question is, you know, how you answer these questions about priority access, and, you know, and as the commercial carriers have pointed out, well, folks, during those periods of time in which first responders have high need for the spectrum, say there's a, you know, some sort of natural disaster or terrorist attack, those are also the times when commercial users tend to want to make a whole lot of those calls to see if, you know, if their loved ones are okay.
Well, I guess now they can just go on Facebook and say,
yeah, that's the most efficient way to do it.
Right.
Yep.
I guess as a policy girl, I keep learning that you tech guys get there much faster than us and have it figured out. You lay in wait for the policies to be put in place.
Well, I mean, we build these technologies, but we don't always understand what they're going to be good for. And then consumers tell us what they're actually good for. And we go, oh, okay, that's what we did. Now I understand. Let me go change that a little bit so that it actually does what you want. I mean, when we designed Wi-Fi, we didn't design Wi-Fi with the thought that it was going to be a system for accessing the internet.
What did you have in mind?
In 1990, you know, the internet was just an academic toy. Like, and most of the networking that was done by actual businesses didn't even use TCP/IP. It was a system call from Novell and Microsoft that operated in a completely different way. And what we thought we were doing with Wi-Fi was making a system for sharing printers.
Right, as you said in the beginning of this, so that was really, I didn't realize that was the core value that you were going for, sharing printers. Now, of course, it seems like I hardly ever print anything, but that's probably a good thing for the environment.
Yeah, and then Al Gore came along and opened the internet up to the public, which is the thing that it already existed before then, but it was a private academic network, and Al Gore, to his credit, made it a public network. And that, you know, that completely changed the use case for Wi-Fi, and it is, you know, it's what it is today, largely as a result of that decision to open the internet up to the public.
Well, I guess we can be thankful that all that came about. You mentioned at the opening virtual reality, and you saw that that was a really big thing at AEI or not AEI at CES. Is that something that you want to talk about today?
We can pick that up in a later podcast. I mean, I think it's I wrote a blog post about it. People can check that out. The argument that I'm making is that virtual reality today is primarily, you know, for entertainment. It's for playing games. It also has some applications in medicine, especially in psychiatry, and also in education and for interpersonal communication. But to me, the thing that follows virtual reality is what's called augmented reality. And so that's when you take the ability to present users with artificial 3D images that look like they're real, and you put that into something like the Google glasses that are the butt of so many jokes, connect it to the cloud, and then make it part of your experience as you're sort of moving through the world, as you're navigating around in your car, you're walking down sidewalks, you're in meetings, you need access to information as you're just living your life. That's augmented reality, I think, is going to be the big thing.
I feel like they keep trying that between the Google glasses, the Apple Watch. They keep trying to get technology closer and closer to our body, but we've yet to find the right form factor.
Well, there's that, and there's the fact that some pieces, there's an awful lot of technology that needs to be in place for that to be a really functional, practical, useful system. And so there are about four or five different things. You need to have really small chips. You need to have really inobtrusive, glasses. You need to have extremely high-speed wireless communication systems. It all needs to be very power efficient. You need to have applications. You need to have the cloud. So there may be a dozen pieces of technology that need to be deployed before that can really take off. But when that final piece is installed, I think it just takes off like really quickly.
So that could be what we're looking at in the next year or the year to come. Hence, your 2017 could be the year.
Yeah, so 2017 or 2018 could be the year for augmented reality. But, you know, the 5G network has to actually be widely deployed and running pretty well, I think, for that to happen.
Well, fascinating. Well, I look forward to hearing that podcast when you're ready to record it.
All right. Well, and enjoy talking to you today. And so let's wrap it up here. And there you have it. If you enjoyed this podcast, go to iTunes and give us a rating. And if you really liked it, give us a review. And if you'd like to discuss what you've heard here, you can do that on the hightechforum.org blog, spelled just like it sounds. We'll be back soon with another podcast for your listening pleasure. We generally do these every 2 weeks unless something special comes up, and then we'll insert a special episode in the schedule. If there's someone in particular you'd like to hear, drop us a note at our email address, info@hightechforum.org, and we'll see what we can do. So once again, thanks for listening, and be excellent to each other.